Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by Melissa Bonnet. This is being recorded on October 30th, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Ahead of Tanzania's election, Maasai fight to stay put. The Trump-Harris worldview divide, fly solo or with allies. Creativity as a small nation's defense. The economy has improved. Here's why it's still a top issue in crucial Pennsylvania. And following up with miscellaneous articles. We start with ahead of Tanzania's election, Maasai fight to stay put, written by Kizito Makoi, who is a contributor in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. On a chilly morning in mid-August, Daudi Seningo set off as usual from his home on Tanzania's Serengeti Plain, his horned cattle lazily roaming alongside him. Their bells clanged softly. For as long as he could remember, tending to his herd here had been his life's purpose and a connection to his pastoral Maasai heritage. Quote, "I love my livestock as much as I love my family," says the 40-something father of seven. Now, however, Mr. Seningo's way of life was under siege. Since 2022, the Tanzanian government had relocated more than 9,600 Maasai from this corner of the country. It claimed their presence threatened the conservation of the area's world-famous acai-dotted landscapes. But watching that same land being carved up for safari parks and trophy hunting reserves, Maasai and their supporters suspected less pure motives. And the pressure was still building. That morning, as Mr. Seningo walked beside his cows, he got a call from a friend. The man told him to check his voter registration. When he did, Mr. Seningo discovered that for the local government elections on November 27th, he had not been assigned to vote in his own village, as he always had in the past. Instead, he had to cast his ballot in the town of Masomara, a seven-hour bus ride away. Although Mr. Seningo had never been there, the name was familiar. It was the location of the settlement the government had built for Maasai, whom it had moved out of the Serengeti. Looking at his registration, Mr. Seningo feared he would be next. Quote, "First, they banned us from grazing in certain areas. Now they don't even want us to vote in our own villages," he says. Quote, "It feels like they're pushing us out," end quote. Pristine landscapes. Around the time Mr. Seningo learned about his new polling station, more than 40,000 other Maasai made the same discovery. Their registration had been moved to Masomara, only 3 months ahead of voting day on November 27th, according to Givness Aswile, a spokesperson for the Independent National Electoral Commission. The decision sounded alarm bells among many Maasai, who saw it as a tactic to further weaken their formal connection to their land. Historically, the Maasai have herded their cattle on the plains that straddle northern Tanzania and southern Kenya. Today, most Maasai in Tanzania live in a district called Ngorongoro. But they are far from the only ones with an interest in that land. The site of one of the largest animal migrations on Earth and unique geological features like the world's largest volcanic caldera, Ngorongoro has long been a magnet for all kinds of global do-gooders and adventure seekers and their money. Today, its game reserves draw about 750,000 tourists a year. The region is a particularly beloved holiday destination of the Dubai royal family, who came by private jet to shoot lions and other wildlife in their own private game reserve. One sheikh recently signed a deal to lease a vast swatch of Tanzania's forests, totaling 8% of the country's land, for a carbon offset business. Part of the region's allure is its supposed emptiness, a place that appears untouched by humans. Tanzania's government says the growing Maasai communities in the region threaten both the wildlife and natural environment. Since 2022, it has used a variety of tactics to compel Maasai to leave Ngorongoro. On protected land, their cattle grazing has been severely restricted and key water supplies cut off. Social services such as hospitals and schools have been shuttered. Some Maasai communities have been evicted by force, while others have taken buyouts to move out of the region. To date, about 10,000 Maasai have moved to Masamera, a town more than 300 miles away in a dry, wind-swept part of eastern Tanzania. There, large polygamous families are crowded into single houses, and people say the parched land is not suitable for grazing their herds. Quote, "It's very difficult. We are losing our way of life," says Edwin Nengoe, a father of eight from two wives. He moved to Masamera in March after accepting a government offer of 10 million Tanzanian shillings, about $3,600, and a small house. Dignity at stake. In mid-August, Mr. Seningo joined a large group of Maasai in staging protest marches, calling for their voter registration to be changed back to Ngorongoro. One human rights activist estimated that thousands of people joined the demonstrations. Quote, "If the relocation exercise is voluntary, why have they removed villages," end quote, from the list of local wards, asks James Maringe, a counselor for Aletol Ward in Ngorongoro. Demonstrators marched with banners carrying messages like, quote, "We will fight for our land until the end," end quote, singing and tearfully reciting prayers as they went. They blocked roads, cutting off access to the Toyota Land Cruisers that carried binocular-wielding safari tourists into the conservation area each day. Quote, "When our right to vote is taken away, our dignity, too, is at stake," explains Rose Njolo, a local leader who was part of the protests. At first, the government denied there was any problem with the voter roll. But after 5 days of protest and an emergency court order to reinstate the Ngorongoro wards, removed from the voter roll, a representative of the president arrived to address the demonstrators. Quote, "All eligible citizens in Ngorongoro will be allowed to vote in their respective areas, just like any other Tanzanians," explained William Lukuvi, a cabinet minister, according to local television reports. Supposedly it was a victory, but Mr. Seningo and other demonstrators cannot shake the feeling that the fight isn't over. Many Maasai say that after the problems they faced, they could no longer vote for the ruling Chama Cha Mapinduzi, or CCM, party. Quote, "How can I support a party that doesn't respect our rights?" asks Mr. Seningo, who was previously a loyal CCM supporter. Supporting the opposition, however, is no simple choice in Tanzania, where non-CCM candidates and supporters are frequently harassed and intimidated. During the last local government elections in 2019, the opposition chose to boycott the vote altogether in protest against CCM manipulation of the polls. For the Maasai, the goal of the election is simple: to choose representatives who support their right to be in Ngorongoro. Quote, "This land is everything to us," Mr. Seningo says, quote, "and we will fight to stay," end quote. The Trump-Harris worldview divide, fly solo or with allies, written by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer in Washington. In most polls, asking voters to list the issues that will influence their choice in next week's presidential election, foreign policy fares little better than an also-ran. The economy, immigration, reproductive rights, and threats to democracy come out on top. Yet at the same time, some surveys, such as the Chicago Council on Global Affairs annual gauge of public opinion and foreign policy, show that Americans still want to see the United States play a leadership role in international affairs. Moreover, some voters suggest that a candidate's worldview and actions on the world stage provide evidence of his or her character and leadership style, and whether that fits with their own vision of how American leadership should be exercised. Viewed through that prism, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump appear to offer distinct foreign policy visions that spring from very different worldviews. In the case of Vice President Harris, a range of foreign policy experts use these words or phrases to describe her worldview: multilateral, cooperation, security through alliances, continuity, or Biden-light. But words like nebulous and undefined also pop up. For former President Trump, the words and phrases these experts say capture his worldview are based on his term in office: unilateral, America first, transactional, but chaotic and unpredictable, even volatile and dangerous make a showing. For many analysts, the biggest difference between the two presidential candidates when it comes to U.S. relations with the world can be boiled down to two words: multilateral and unilateral. Does America really need its friends? More broadly, Vice President Harris is seen as a champion of America's traditional post-World War II role, leading alliances of like-minded democracies. Think NATO, the Organization of American States, and the more recent Asia-Pacific Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad, grouping, and promoting the post-war liberal world order. President Trump, on the other hand, established a record of disdain for America's alliances. He is seen as more comfortable with the idea of the U.S. defending its own interests in an era of rising big power competition. Quote, "We don't know for sure, but my guess is that Harris is likelier to be open to investing American assets and treasure, if you can get allies and international institutions to go along," says Corey Shake, Director of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, or AEI, in Washington. Quote, "Trump is more likely to be comfortable with unilateral action," she adds. Quote, "While Harris will be unwilling to take a position that no one else would align with," end quote. Beneath the unilateral versus multilateral question lie differing views of the costs and benefits of maintaining Washington's global leadership role. Quote, "Americans got used to hearing that our military actions in Somalia or Iraq or Libya were part of our global leadership," says Paul Sanders, president of the Center for the National Interest in Washington. But Mr. Trump has tapped into a growing sense among Americans that the costs of that leadership are increasingly outweighing the benefits, he suggests. Weighing the costs and benefits of U.S. leadership. Vice President Harris would adhere to a more conventional foreign policy and leadership style, consulting both her aides and foreign allies, says Mr. Saunders. Mr. Trump, he predicts, would rely more on his own instincts and his ambition to, quote, close the deal, end quote, even though, quote, his record is very mixed when it comes to foreign policy, end quote. His quick report card for President Trump, success in clinching the Abraham Accords that normalized relations between Israel and a number of Arab countries, and success with a modest rewrite and update of the North American trade deal, then called NAFTA. Quote, but there was no big deal with Russia or North Korea or Iran, Mr. Saunders adds. Quote, nor was there any deal with Beijing that the Chinese stuck to, end quote. As a vice president, Ms. Harris has not been free to hew her own foreign policy path. She would be most likely to differentiate herself from President Biden in relations with Israel, showing a willingness to stand up sooner and more publicly to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, some experts say. The clearest differences between the two presidential candidates, though, are likely to emerge over Ukraine. Candidate Ms. Harris has framed Russia's invasion of Ukraine in the same terms as the Biden administration, calling it a violation of international law and a threat to European security and democracy. She has echoed President Biden's vow of, quote, support as long as it takes, end quote. Mr. Trump, on the other hand, has insisted he would end the war in a day, drawing in part on his relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. While the former president has offered no details of how he would conclude a peace accord, some former aides say his deal would mean significant territorial concessions by Ukraine, with little concern for how such a solution would go over with European allies. Quote, Harris would continue with the establishment consensus on supporting Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and the Ukrainians, says Michael Desch, director of the Notre Dame International Security Center in Indiana. Quote, but Trump is a different story. He's not committed to helping Ukraine. We already know he's a NATO skeptic, he adds. Quote, and he thinks he can do business with Vladimir Putin, end quote. Is Trump better in tune with today's world? There are good reasons to doubt the likelihood of a magic formula quickly ending Russia's war in Ukraine, Dr. Desch says. But at the same time, he suggests that much about Mr. Trump's approach to foreign policy may fit better than Ms. Harris's approach with today's world. Quote, so much of the establishment fixation with American leadership is nostalgia for the unipolar moment that is past, he says. On the other hand, he sees Mr. Trump as more comfortable with a world that is, quote, more like late 19th century Europe. America is still a great power, he adds, quote, but there are other great powers out there, including China and Russia, that have to be taken account of, end quote. Ms. Sheikh, the AEI's foreign policy expert, says no one should doubt that the United States needs a strong leader to pursue core national interests in a world that remains highly interdependent. But she is concerned by the authoritarian tone of some of Mr. Trump's remarks. Quote, so many of my fellow Republicans who are reluctantly aligning with Trump acknowledged that things he is saying are terrible, she says. quote, but they say, look at what he does. Don't listen to what he says, end quote. In response, she says, she tells them, quote, you would always say that we should take Putin and Chinese leader Xi Jinping at their word. So how is it wise to ignore the words of Donald Trump? End quote. Creativity as a small nation's defense. Armenia, surrounded by bigger countries, tries to make itself indispensable by becoming a Silicon Valley in a precarious region. Written by the Monitor's editorial board. One trend of recent decades has been that of small countries trying to prevent a foreign invasion by making themselves indispensable to big countries around them. Singapore, Taiwan, and the United Arab Emirates, for example, have become global tech hubs or finance centers. A would-be invader might think twice before destroying what it is dependent on. The secret of this strategy? Build up trust in your economy and bring out the creativity of your people. Rely on qualities more than on armaments. Now, Armenia, population under 3 million, is racing to go down the path of becoming the next Silicon Valley, especially after seeing Russia invade Ukraine. In fact, the former Soviet state got a big head start in 2022 when thousands of Russian techies fled their country after the invasion and chose Armenia, a democracy, because of its ecosystem of hundreds of dynamic tech startups. Around the size of Maryland, Armenia faces a foe different from Russia, with which it has recently had mixed relations. Last year, neighboring Azerbaijan, population 10 million, invaded a disputed region called Nagorno-Karabakh, forcing more than 100,000 ethnic Armenians to flee the enclave. Both countries are currently negotiating a peace deal, but Azerbaijan still has eyes on a vital transit route in Armenia called the Zangezur Corridor. Iran and Turkey, which border Armenia, have strong opinions on that hot territorial dispute. Quote, for Armenia, a country that faces complex geopolitical challenges, leveraging science and technology is not only about economic growth, but also national security, resilience, and sustainability. Alan Simoyan, Speaker of Parliament, said at a conference in October. Last year, Armenia doubled the number of tech workers from the year before. Several American tech giants have opened offices or research centers in the country. In early October, the country hosted the World Congress on Innovation and Technology. Quote, Armenia's survival, which now faces existential threats, is of great importance. Valerie Safarian, head of the Belgian-Armenian Chamber of Commerce, told Armen Press, Armenian news agency. Quote, it's important to underscore that Armenia has strategic assets, particularly in the sector of semiconductors and electronic chips, end quote. But it is the country's fearless drive to innovate that may be its first defense. Quote, when creating startups, people think, what if we aren't good enough? Tigran Petrosian, a co-founder of the startup Armenia Foundation, told Armen Press last year, quote, I'd advise everyone to make the steps forward and understand the reality while doing so. There's only one way here. Keep moving forward regardless of anything. End quote. The economy has improved. Here's why it's still a top issue in crucial Pennsylvania. Written by Simone Montlake, who is a staff writer in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. As an independent voter living in a battleground state, Elizabeth Brown has mixed feelings about former President Donald Trump. She's not crazy about his proposed tariffs or the tone of his rhetoric, she says. But when he was in office, her salary as a sales manager stretched further. She paid less for her apartment in Bethlehem and could put more meat in her grocery cart. And she hasn't been able to discern how Vice President Kamala Harris would be any different from President Joe Biden. Under Mr. Trump, quote, the economy was good. We didn't have this situation on the border, Ms. Brown says. Next week, she's leaning toward casting her vote for him. For much of the past year, Mr. Trump led Mr. Biden by wide margins on the question of which candidate voters trusted more to handle the economy. Since Ms. Harris became the Democratic nominee this summer, however, she has closed that gap in most national polls as economic indicators have grown increasingly rosy. Recent data has underscored the strength of the U.S. economic recovery. Low unemployment, rising wages for most workers, and GDP growth that outpaces other major economies. Inflation, which peaked at 9.1% in 2022, has fallen to 2.4%, and interest rates have come down, making mortgages more affordable. Yet many voters say they're not feeling it, and polls show the economy remains a top concern in Pennsylvania and other battleground states. One reason is that economic growth hasn't translated into easy living for many middle-class Americans who blame politicians in Washington for the still high cost of groceries, gas, and other necessities. Nostalgia for the pre-pandemic Trump economy is palpable in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, a hub of manufacturing and logistics a few hours west of New York City and New Jersey. Despite the row of decommissioned blast furnaces looming over Bethlehem, where steelmaking once employed tens of thousands of workers, this is no hollowed-out Rust Belt community. Job growth in healthcare and education and proximity to major cities has attracted newcomers, boosted employment, and raised household incomes in the bi-county region. Factories are hiring unskilled workers starting at $20 an hour, says Don Cunningham, president of the Lehigh Valley Economic Development Corp and a former mayor of Bethlehem. And unlike in previous eras, other job opportunities abound. Quote, my old man worked in the steel mills. For the dollar he made in the mills, he couldn't go anywhere else, even if he hated his job, he says. Still, frustration over the increased cost of living runs deep here, even as wages are rising. This is what voters usually mean when they say their top priority for picking a president is the economy, says Christopher Borick, a political science professor and director of the Institute of Public Opinion at Muhlenberg College in Allentown. Quote, inflation is the lens by which those evaluations are ultimately made, he says. Mr. Trump had held a rally in Allentown on Tuesday, a sign of the region's importance in the waning days of the campaign. When he asked the crowd if they were better off than they were 4 years ago, many yelled no. This has created a quandary for Ms. Harris, who is campaigning as a next-generation changemaker, while serving as vice president at a time when a majority of voters say the country is on the wrong track. Should she try to take credit for an economic recovery that is the envy of other industrialized nations, or disavow its uneven distribution among a disgruntled electorate? She has promised to, quote, turn the page, end quote, while struggling to explain what exactly she would do or would have done differently from Mr. Biden. Quote, Harris has aligned herself with Biden, says Ms. Brown, the independent voter. Quote, we don't know what she would do as president because she's not explained it well. End quote. Swing region in a swing state. Northampton and Lehigh counties together make up the Lehigh Valley, named for the river that bisects the region. While Lehigh County, population 378,000, is anchored by Allentown, the third largest city in Pennsylvania, and is reliably Democratic, Northampton, population 313,000, is a swing county that voted twice for Barack Obama, then for Mr. Trump in 2016, and for Mr. Biden in 2020. It has backed the winning candidate in all but three presidential elections over the past century. Both parties have mounted expansive and expensive efforts to reach voters in Northampton's mid-sized cities, suburban townships, and rural communities, which distill the demographics of a typical northeastern U.S. state, increasingly diverse, plugged into global markets, economically unequal, into a single geographical area. Quote, Northampton County is probably the best bellwether county in the state, says Charlie Dent, who presented the Lehigh Valley in Congress from 2005 to 2018. Who represented the Lehigh Valley in Congress? Quote, whichever presidential candidate wins there, I believe is going to win Pennsylvania and the presidency, end quote. Polls show the two presidential candidates are effectively tied in Pennsylvania, which has 19 electoral votes, the most of any swing state. Mr. Trump won the state in 2016 by fewer than 45,000 votes. Mr. Biden flipped it in 2020 by running up the tally in cities and suburbs. Victory in Northampton may hinge on whether undecided voters see Ms. Harris as a safe choice to shepherd the economy, says Mr. Dent, a moderate Republican who broke with his party and endorsed Mr. Biden in 2020. Quote, I suspect many are saying, hey, maybe I was doing a little better under Trump, but they don't like Trump very much because they don't like his behavior, end quote. Mr. Dent has already cast an early vote for Ms. Harris, joining a swell of former GOP officials in Pennsylvania and other states trying to defeat Mr. Trump. Quote, she and I will not agree on every issue, but in her, we have a capable leader who will always put the interests of our country before her own, unlike her opponent, who will always put his personal interests ahead of those of the United States, he said in a statement. In recent weeks, the Harris campaign has sharpened its focus on wooing disaffected Republicans and right-leaning independents in swing states. But it also needs to turn out irregular voters in cities like Bethlehem and Allentown by convincing them that inflation is in the rearview mirror and focusing on what a Harris presidency could achieve. Benefits versus tax cuts. Ms. Harris has offered a raft of policy ideas on housing, taxation, and children care benefits. Mr. Trump has proposed tax cuts on tipped wages and Social Security benefits while promising across-the-board tariffs on imported goods. He also favors reducing regulations and taxes on corporations, as he did in his first term when he signed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017. Economists have warned that Mr. Trump's tariffs and other fiscal policies would create more inflation and bigger deficits than Ms. Harris's plans. Amid this debate over future tax and spending plans, Mr. Trump's core argument is mostly backward-looking. The economy was better when he was in charge, he has said repeatedly during the campaign. Quote, we had the greatest economy in the history of our country, he told a Fox News town hall on October 16th. At a dinner in Allentown, Richard Cromer is collecting prizes for a Veterans of Foreign Wars raffle. An Army veteran, he later worked at a zinc processor in Tennessee before retiring in 2021 and moving back to Pennsylvania to take care of his father. He likes Mr. Trump, but has major misgivings about his policy on Ukraine, which Mr. Cromer wants the U.S. to support. On the economy, though, he's not conflicted. Mr. Trump, quote, had a very strong economy until COVID hit, he says, ticking off his disagreements with Ms. Harris, quote, all she has done is put up prices. She doesn't understand how inflation works, end quote. Other voters are more approving of the administration's economic stewardship and more wary of Mr. Trump's self-justifications and threats to imprison his foes. Quote, it's all about him and what he wants, says Roger Aris, a retired restaurant owner in Bethlehem. Ms. Harris has to be loyal to President Biden, he says, but once in office, he believes she would put her own stamp on fiscal policy. Quote, instead of giving tax breaks to millionaires or billionaires, she wants to help poorer people, he says. Mr. Aris, who is 74, was born in Haiti and worked for decades in New York City before moving to Bethlehem. He has four children and 11 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. His children, however, don't all share his enthusiasm for Ms. Harris. Jacqueline Harris, who lives in Bethlehem with her four children, says the economy was better under Mr. Trump. She's not planning to vote at all this time. Quote, whichever party wins, we're all screwed, she says. Her friend, Stacy Miller, who works in human resources, says she will vote for Ms. Harris because she wants a woman in the White House. But she's also feeling economically pinched, unable to afford a bigger house for her family. Quote, the bills keep coming, and I don't want to pay them, she says. One Democrat's appeal in a tight House race. Quote, V is for voting, to make your voice heard, says Susan Wild, holding a picture book up for 12 fidgeting preschoolers sitting on an alphabet-themed rug. She smiles at the group assembled inside a brightly lit classroom and turns the page to the next letter. In 2018, Ms. Wild, a Democrat, was elected to Mr. Dent's former House seat and is now locked in a tight race. One of two in Pennsylvania that could help decide control of the U.S. House. She's running against Ryan McKenzie, a GOP state representative from the region who has run for Congress in two other cycles. Today, Representative Wild is touring a child care center in Easton that has branches across her district. Her own children, now adults, attended one, she tells the staff. Last year, she sponsored the Child Care for Working Families Act, which would cap child care expenditures at 7% of a family's income and make it free to low-income families. She says passing that bill, which has also been introduced in the Senate, would be her priority if reelected. Quote, what I'm hearing from people is that their child care expenses rank right up there with their rent or mortgage, she says in an interview. But she also highlights low gas prices and wages that are finally growing faster than inflation. She tells voters Mr. Biden's policies are working and that control of the House would make it possible for Democrats to do even more. Still, she concedes that the feel-good factor isn't quite there yet. Quote, when people find that they're earning more, they want to feel it. They want to feel like they've got the ability to buy a luxury item or go on vacation. If it's just assisting you in getting by, you don't feel like you're really making more, she says. For those who don't own a home, the cost of rent is a constant gripe. But it predates the pandemic and has partly been driven by newcomers from nearby states seeking cheaper housing. What has changed in recent years and is keeping demand high is growth in local employment, says Mr. Cunningham. Coattail effects? Even if Mr. Trump flips Northampton County, ticket splitters may reelect Representative Wild, who has outraised her opponent and blanketed local airwaves with attack ads. Pennsylvania also has a Senate seat in the balance, with Senator Bob Casey, the Democratic incumbent, holding a narrow polling lead over David McCormick, the Republican nominee. Both campaigns have each spent more than $100 million to elect their candidate. Glenn Geisinger, chair of the Republican Party in Northampton County, says he's confident that down-ballot Republicans will get a boost from the coattails of the presidential nominee, unlike in 2016, when Mr. Trump won over irregular voters who didn't necessarily vote the entire GOP ticket. In 2016, quote, "I think people were going in and saying, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump only," he says. Quote, "The average American who is voting for Donald Trump now says, I need control of the Senate, I need control of the House, so that the policies that he wants to pass can be instituted," end quote. At a car wash in Easton, Chris Ozamina is waiting for his Hyundai sedan before driving back to his shift as a line manager at a medical manufacturing plant. His family of four is, quote, "getting by," he says, though he'd like to see lower food prices. But he doesn't put much stock in the promises of any of the presidential candidates. He's also sympathetic to Mr. Biden, calling him an honorable man who was unceremoniously pushed aside by his party. To Mr. Ozamena, leadership sometimes means making incremental progress and being humble enough to admit it. Quote, "You're not going to make America perfect. Just do your bit for 4 or 8 years," he says. Elections. Making a choice. Where does power truly belong during election period and beyond? From A Christian Science Perspective by Judith Hedrick. Elections are times of choice. Yes, whenever an election is held, we decide on different issues and between political parties and their candidates. But we also make a deeper choice about what we believe is the power which governs. What is the ultimate power governing me? My family and friends, my country, and even the world? Is it human personalities, or is it God? Is it mortal mind, or the divine mind? Where do I put my faith? Any polarization or conflict that arises in elections is the result of the belief that power belongs to people who have both good and evil qualities, instead of to God. We get riled up because we are convinced that there are candidates whose political positions and activities will harm us. If personalities are able to rule, we do have reason to fear. The Bible points us in a different direction, though. Quote, "Power belongeth unto God," end quote, from Psalms 62, line 11. Accepting that God, good, is all-powerful and governing human existence frees us from fear and distress. The Bible also says, "I am the Lord and there is none else," from Isaiah 45:6. This shows us that the enemy is not a person. It is the false belief that there is a power, mind, or presence other than God. Ignorance and fear are overcome through Christ, the true idea of God. When Pilate asked Christ Jesus before his crucifixion, "Whence art thou?" he didn't answer. So Pilate asked Jesus whether he knew that as Roman governor, he had the power to kill or free him. Jesus answered, "Thou couldst have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above," from John 19:11. Jesus wasn't afraid. He understood that power belonged to God and not to Pilate. To Jesus, God wasn't just a large power in a world full of smaller powers. God's spirit was all, the only power. Thus he knew there is no real evil power or mind which could prevent him from fulfilling God's will and completing his mission. He would be victorious no matter how it looked at that point. And in the resurrection, he was indeed victorious. The first and second commandments in Exodus 20, 3 and 4 can help us guard our thought against resigning ourselves to any claim of evil, the way Jesus guarded his thought. The first commandment teaches us to have no other gods before God. We are to have or worship no other power, no other presence, no other might nor mind. From this basis, we become confident that God is our King and Christ our Savior, and that nothing else, not even politicians or political parties, can save or destroy. The second commandment brings out that what tempts us away from God are images, mortal beliefs of material or personal good or of evil, all graven or carved into thought, and all denying the supremacy of God. We're not to make, quote, any graven image, end quote, the commandment says. News reporting, social media, television convey many images of material power or powerlessness. We make a graven image of what we read or hear when we simply take the false beliefs into our thought, rather than letting Christ lift our thinking higher and refusing to honor any power but God, good. Conversely, as we love and worship God, we lose our fear of evil. When the fear is gone, we are able to make intelligent decisions during elections. We will select what represents the highest right under the circumstances. If our candidate doesn't win and another does, we have the opportunity to continue to make a wise choice. Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of this news organization, wrote, quote, "Between the centripetal and centrifugal mental forces of material and spiritual gravitations, we go into or we go out of materialism or sin, and choose our course and its results, which then shall be our choice, the sinful, material, and perishable, or the spiritual, joy-giving, and eternal." End quote. From Miscellaneous Writings, 1883 to 1896, page 19. We can choose the spiritual and go forward as Jesus did with a full faith in God, who is ceaselessly working his purpose out. As we choose to honor the supremacy of spirit, it is natural to maintain our higher view of and trust in the reality and influence of God's power, whoever wins high office. We can know that the guidance and direction of God, love, who is perfect good, is present with those elected, as well as with all who are part of the national government. And we can pray for their receptivity to that wisdom and understanding. We can continue forward, choosing to know that, quote, "the kingdom is the Lord's, and he is the governor among the nations," end quote. Psalms 22, 28. And on the book review page, Justice Delayed, Why It's So Hard to Free the Wrongfully Convicted, by Terry W. Hartle, who is a contributor. In March 1987, a white businessman was robbed, beaten, and left for dead on a Dallas street. Ben Spencer, a black man, was convicted in the murder, but that conviction was overturned and a second trial granted. Though Spencer had proclaimed his innocence from the beginning, he was found guilty of aggravated robbery and sentenced to life in prison. It would take over three decades before he was exonerated. As Barbara Bradley Haggerty describes in Bringing Ben Home, A Murder, A Conviction, and the Fight to Redeem American Justice, getting freed can be a terribly long, torturous process for people who find themselves wrongfully convicted, especially black defendants who, studies show, are significantly more likely to be wrongfully convicted than their white counterparts. Spencer's saga is a depressing tale of a rushed and incomplete police investigation, a lousy defense attorney, prosecutorial misconduct, false testimony, and witnesses compromised by cash rewards. In late 1989, Spencer reached out from prison to Centurion Ministries, a nonprofit that seeks to free the wrongfully convicted. After a decade of exchanging letters and examining the trial record, Jim McCloskey, the head of the group, visited Spencer and became convinced of his innocence. But the stubborn reluctance of the Texas legal system to acknowledge Spencer's wrongful conviction proved to be a tall barrier. The problem, Haggerty writes, is twofold. First, the rush to solve a crime, especially a highly publicized one, is a powerful incentive that leads some in the legal system to cut corners. Second, the legal system's reluctance to acknowledge its mistakes virtually ensures that some wrongs are never corrected. Even when questions are raised about the evidence and witnesses underpinning a conviction. Ultimately, Spencer gained his freedom because a few determined individuals would not let the case rest. What would have happened if one of them had looked away or abandoned the effort? As one advocate told Haggerty, quote, "It comes down to, really, serendipity, dot, dot, dot. That's what makes this so difficult. We should not be having to depend on luck," end quote. This is not a storybook ending. It is an unvarnished tale of justice, too long delayed. While he was in prison, Spencer's wife, Deborah, divorced him, with his permission, and married another man. Spencer's son, born while he was in jail, awaiting his first trial, grew up not knowing his father. After his release, Spencer and Deborah, who by then had divorced her second husband, remarried, and Spencer began to build a relationship with his son. John Crozote, the new head of the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, which had prosecuted Spencer's case in the first place, decided to review the case. Eventually, he was persuaded that witnesses who had placed Spencer at the crime scene were lying or irrevocably compromised. He asked the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals to vacate Spencer's robbery conviction, and the court earlier this year agreed. Haggerty's book is about more than the injustice dealt to one man. This is a compelling, important, and deeply unsettling account because it makes clear the extent to which the legal cards can be too easily stacked against poor people and members of minority groups. And just a quick little snippet from To the People of Sudan, We See You, from the editors, by Ryan Lenora Brown. She said, earlier this year, I received an email from a Monitor reader asking why we had published so little about the civil war in Sudan. The message jolted me. As the Monitor's Africa editor, I realized I was neglecting an urgent story because I was listening to a cynical voice in my head that said, no one will care. The world is full of terrible news at the moment, and frankly, I wondered if people had the bandwidth for even more. I should have known better. Monitor readers do care. Having empathy for one place doesn't mean you can't also have empathy for another. It isn't a zero-sum game. This was a useful reminder because I have always felt that my job as a journalist is to draw the world in closer. I think the best reporting is the kind that helps us brush up against people and situations that feel far away inexplicable, or simply hopeless. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by Melissa Bonnet.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.